Today, we will study the so-called energy-momentum tensor. Energy and momentum in general relativity are quite non-trivial concepts because, as we will find out, they're no longer conserved. In flat space-time, in non-gravitational physics, we know from Noether's theorem that translation invariance in time, so the fact that the laws of nature are the same no matter when you do your experiment, translates into energy conservation. And the fact that it doesn't matter where you perform your experiment, so translation invariance in space leads to conservation of momentum, and the fact that it doesn't matter in which orientation you perform your experiment leads to angular momentum conservation by Noether's theorem. But in general relativity, it can matter. It can matter where you are, where you do it, the experiment. If you do it inside a black hole, the conditions are somewhat different if you do that outside. And so overall, in general, there's not going to be translation invariance in time or space or rotation invariance. So we should not expect that there is, on this non-trivially shaped stage, space-time, curved space-time, we should not expect that there is conservation of energy and momentum. But there still should be something like energy and momentum, just not being conserved. There should be flows of energy, flows of momentum and of angular momentum. And as you may know, these concepts are still very useful, even in gravitational contexts. For example, when two galaxies collide, then it would be nice, and it is actually possible, to come up with concepts of energy momentum that describe energies, energy flows, energy balance, momentum balance, angular momentum balance, even when it comes to the collision of galaxies. So the question for now is, how do we identify these flows of energy and flows of momentum, and how do we identify under which circumstances they still are conserved, and when are they not conserved? But what are the quantities? What quantity captures energy and momentum and their flow? Clearly, that quantity, whatever it is, will have to be very sensitive to changes in the space-time curvature. And this motivates to study the following quantity. We take the action, S, which is the Klein-Gordon action for scalar fields, the electromagnetic action, and the QCD action, weak interaction action, all the matter and radiation fields actions, and we functionally differentiate that action with respect to the metric. So we ask, how much does the action change under a change of the metric, if we vary the metric? We're going to get a quantity, let's call it tau mu nu, and that tau mu nu is going to be sensitive to curvature, obviously. So on one hand, studying this quantity is motivated by the fact that energy and momentum clearly have to be sensitive to variations in the metric, to variations in the shape of the manifold, therefore. But there's also another motivation. If you remember from the previous lecture, we took the action and we differentiated it with respect to the various fields. If we differentiate it with respect to a Dirac field, then we get the Dirac equation. If we differentiate with respect to a Klein-Gordon field, we get the Klein-Gordon equation, just by the action principle. Now, eventually, we want to derive the Einstein equation. We want to derive an equation of motion for gravity itself. And the expectation is that we will be able to do that, again, through an action principle, where the variation is not with respect to some matter or radiation field, but the variation is with respect to the metric. So here we are calculating the variation of the action of all of the matter and radiation fields with respect to the metric. That expression that we get should be at least part of the equation of motion for gravity. And it will indeed turn out to be the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. what's missing to make this functional differentiation give us the Einstein equation is that we also need an action for gravity itself. So far here, we are only considering the action of the matter and radiation fields, and we functional differentiate that with respect to G mu nu. Later, we will add the gravity action and then the functional differentiation of all of this, the matter action plus the gravity action with respect to G mu nu, set equal to zero, will give us the Einstein equation. Okay, but for now, we are not that far yet. We're just checking what is the sensitivity of the matter action with respect to variations in the metric. And when I say matter, I mean, you know, matter and radiation. So let's calculate that quantity here. We are functionally differentiating, we are varying in the same way that we did in the previous lecture with respect to changes in the metric, which has two lower indices. It's a two-fold covariant tensor, and the functional differentiation therefore will give us something with two upper indices. But is it a tensor? Is it a tensor with two upper indices? And the answer is not quite. But first, how exactly do we do that? Well, we define a variation of the metric in the same way that we defined variations of fields before. Namely, we start with the deformation. So we write g mu nu of lambda nx is a deformation of the metric in some region B that is just some chunk of the all of the manifold, but we do the variation only in some region B. It's called a deformation, a one-parameter deformation, if when the parameter value lambda is chosen equal to zero, then we haven't deformed it yet. So then g mu nu of 0, x is just g mu nu of x. But for non-zero lambda values in a continuous fashion, a differentiable fashion, we are changing the g mu nu. And outside the region B, the deformation should always be 0. So the metric g mu nu lambda of x should just be g mu nu of x outside the region, B. And then we write that the variation, that's just a definition, it's a notation, we write that the variation of g mu nu of x is the derivative of this one-parameter family of metrics with respect to lambda evaluated at lambda equal to 0. Obviously, there are infinitely many such variations. Now, however, we are functionally differentiating here with respect to a tensor. So what exactly do we mean here by the derivative? We define that the action S, which is a function of the metric in general, is called functionally differentiable with respect to a variation g mu nu of lambda and x in the region B if this derivative ds by d lambda at lambda equal to 0 exists, and we want it to exist for all smooth deformations, for all infinitely many times differentiable deformations of the metric g mu nu of lambda of x, and if it is of the following form. Ds by d lambda at lambda equal to 0 is some number, and it's supposed to be this number. It's, well, this factor 1/2 is just by convention. It could be defined away. And then it is tau mu nu of x times this variation here. And then we write in this sense that defines what that is, right? So if for all smooth deformations of the metric, we have that ds by d lambda can be written as an integral where we have this object here that looks like a tensor times the variation of the metric integrated over. If this can be written in this way, then that expression that we have here will be called tau mu nu. It will be called the functional derivative of S with respect to the metric. Now, this tau mu nu is not a tensor. Later, we will do that in explicitly, so you see how that's done. It's really totally straightforward. It works the way you would expect differentiation to work. but tau mu nu is not a tensor. Now, why is it not a tensor? Let's rewrite the defining equation for tau mu nu again. So here it is. So this is an ordinary derivative here, and we just write it in this form. And here we have our tau mu nu appear. It's not a tensor because that's not a volume form. You see, we know that this is a scalar because S is a scalar, lambda is a scalar, so the whole thing is a scalar. But d4x alone is not a volume form. We need the square root of g here. So let's put a square root of g here so that this becomes a volume form, but then we have to divide by the square root of g, right? And then we know that this is a tensor. So since the whole thing is a scalar, we deduce from this that this is a volume form, that is a tensor, and this, therefore, we deduce is a tensor as well. So the tau alone is not a tensor, but tau divided by square root of g is a tensor. This leads to this motivates a general definition. We say that if M with arbitrarily many contravariant and covariant components is a tensor, so if this is an RS tensor in general, then the M written with a curly script defined as the regular M multiplied with the square root of g is called a tensor density. So that if you take this curly thing, just like this is curly, and divide it by square root of g, you get a tensor. So in this sense, the tau mu nu is not a tensor, but it's a tensor density. It just differs from a tensor by having a 1 over square root of g in front, where g is, of course, the absolute value of the determinant of the metric. So what we have is that tau mu nu, which is defined to be this expression here, is 2 over square root of g, and then the functional differentiation of the action with respect to the metric, that's the energy momentum tensor. And remember that this action here is the matter action. So it has only matter and radiation fields in it. It doesn't contain any action for gravity just yet. Yeah, and this object, this tensor, T mu nu, is called the energy momentum tensor. But we will see why that is a justified name. Clearly, it's very sensitive by its very definition to how the action reacts to changes in the metric. And we should expect that energy momentum are very sensitive to that, because energy and momentum are in flat space an expression of the translation invariance in space and time, and also rotation invariance. But when space becomes curved, then the flows of energy and momentum should be modified in such a way that they're no longer conserved. So it's very sensitive, and this quantity is. Now this quantity, T mu nu, this energy momentum tensor, obeys an equation of this form. It's T mu nu, and then covariant derivative in the new direction, and then contracted. This looks a little bit as if it was a conservation law. It looks like this was, you see, if there was just this one index, then we would have here the statement that if T, capital T, had only one index, one upper index, and if that was true, then we would be able to conclude that this is a divergence, which is zero, and then by Gauss's theorem, we would have a conservation law. No such luck here, because we have another index here. And because of that, this is not really a conservation law, as we will soon see. And it's not a conservation law for an important reason. A conservation law, by Noether's theorem, has an underlying symmetry of space-time. This is almost a conservation law, but what's underlying it is not a symmetry. Because in general, this is true even if the space-time is all wrinkly and curved, no symmetries whatsoever. Still, this is true. No, the origin of this equation is a different one, as we will see later. origin is reparametrization invariance, diffeomorphism invariance. But if there are symmetries, then we can turn that equation into a conservation equation, as we will see today. So we will prove and analyze that equation a little later. Now, let us identify how T mu nu relates to the flows of energy and momentum that are associated with the matter and radiation fields. Basically, why would we call this the energy momentum tensor? For that purpose, let us consider the case where the space-time actually has a symmetry. So we take this for now for granted. We postpone the proof of it and the analysis of why that is true. For now, let's just assume that this is true and then look at the consequences if the space-time has a symmetry. So imagine, for example, that we have a space-time. It's indicated by this thing. It could be like a vase, and this vase, see, this is, you could fill this with water from above or something. And imagine that this vase has a rotation symmetry, for example. So it doesn't have a symmetry upwards, but a symmetry, you know, a translation symmetry in this direction there. In other words, there would exist a diffeomorphism, phi, that maps the manifold in itself. So for example, this point goes into that point goes into this, and so on, such that under the pullback of this diffeomorphism, the metric goes into itself. In this case, we expect the flow of energy or momentum to be conserved. Let's try to identify these flows of energy and momentum through observations of something being conserved. Now, on a space-time, such as this one, consider the infinitesimal flow that is induced by a vector field. You see, here we wrote down a finite phi, a finite diffeomorphism, where this point goes into that point goes into this one. But it suffices to look at infinitesimal translations as well. So we have a diffeomorphism from the manifold into the manifold, which maps the coordinates x mu into the coordinates x mu plus a bit of a vector field psi mu in such a way that the metric goes into itself. So we have a diffeomorphism invariance. And this means, if you remember, this means that the Lie derivative of that quantity is vanishing. So the Lie derivative of the metric here is vanishing. Now, by definition, we say that whenever we have some space-time manifold and a vector field such that the metric doesn't change under the flow induced by that vector field, then we say we have a symmetry here. We have a direction in which we can change coordinates such that actually we obtain the same manifold again. So we say that psi is a symmetry if it induces a flow under which, through the pullback, the metric goes into itself. In other words, in which the Lie derivative, in which direction the Lie derivative of the metric is vanishing. So we recognize that a manifold has a symmetry by checking whether the Lie derivative of the metric in the direction of some vector field is vanishing. If that's the case, then that vector field induces a flow along which the metric doesn't change. Such vector fields are called Killing vector fields, after somebody whose name was Killing. How can we find Killing vector fields? If there are any. Space-time itself, of course, doesn't have Killing vector fields because it's a generic shape. And so it doesn't have exact Killing vector fields. It doesn't have exact symmetries. But oftentimes, it has approximate Killing vector fields. For example, if we average the universe for a fixed time of a long distance in space, if we average in space, it's pretty much translation invariant. And therefore, we have approximately a Killing vector field. But how do we find for a space-time whether or not it has Killing vector fields? Well, for that, we need to solve that equation. The space-time is a given here. It's given by the metric G. And then we are wondering, well, how can we find vector fields psi for which the Lie derivative of G is vanishing? What does that boil down to in terms of explicit equations and coordinates? Well, it turns out that the Lie derivative of a tensor with arbitrarily many contravariant and covariant components is given by the following expression. The Lie derivative is given by the covariant derivative of the coefficient function. That's why there's a semicolon k here, and then contracted with the direction vector in which we differentiate. And then we have terms with negative signs and terms with positive signs in which the coefficient function stays the same, but it's the the direction vector that's now covariantly being differentiated. In the case of a covariant index, we have in the case of a contravariant index, we have that we have the minus signs, and for the covariant indices, we have the plus signs. We have not had that equation before. We expressed the Lie derivative of a tensor previously with another formula, and we did this before we even knew what an affine connection is, before we even introduced a metric. And you may wonder, how come? Well, remember, the Lie derivative, the calculation of the Lie derivative doesn't require knowledge of the affine connection or the metric. And indeed, the formula that we had was the exact same formula, but instead of the semicolons, we had commas. Right? And now I'm claiming that the same equation holds true when we replace the commas with the semicolon. And the trick to proving this is a trick that we used already once before, which is to say, what if I take that equation that I know holds true for commas, and I write it down at the origin of a geodesic or Riemann normal coordinate system? It's true there with the commas, but I also know that the affine connection is vanishing at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system. And that means I can turn the commas into semicolons and it's still true, right? Because the Christoffel symbol is vanishing anyway. So it makes no difference whether I add it or not. So whether I write it with a comma or a semicolon. But having written it in terms of semicolons, I know that the expression is covariant, so it's actually coordinate system independent. And therefore, this is true also in arbitrary coordinate systems. We have to be careful when using this. It only works in one direction, not the other direction. If you know that an equation is true with commas only, then you can replace the commas by semicolons because of that argument. But you can't work the other way around. If something is true with semicolons, it doesn't mean it works with commas. It means it works with commas at the origin of a geodesic coordinate system, but only there.
When we replace these commas with semicolons, we kind of assume that our connection is torsionless, right?
Yes. Yeah, we are always assuming this.
Yeah, and I know that we do, but just in general, this recipe
works
because of the torsion.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. It's a Levi-Civita connection here. Okay, so this means if we apply this now to the Lie derivative of the metric that we want to set equal to zero to discover Killing vector fields psi, it means that for psi to be a Killing vector field for the given space-time described by G, this expression needs to vanish, the Lie derivative of the metric in the direction of psi. And it is, according to this formula here, the covariant derivative of the metric times contracted with psi, and then we have the metric and then covariant derivatives of the direction field. And now we notice that this term is vanishing, because this is the covariant derivative of the metric. The covariant derivative of the metric is vanishing. Remember that? That was a very important equation. It arose when we connected the affine connection to the metric. When we said, yes, we work with the metric connection. And the condition that the metric's covariant derivative is vanishing is expressing that what the metric does is invariant under parallel transport. And what does the metric do? It allows us to calculate lengths and angles. So that condition, the condition that the covariant derivative of the metric is vanishing, remember, it means that under parallel transport, vectors don't change their length. Their length stays the same. And under parallel transport, if you parallel transport two vectors, their relative angle also stays the same. Right? Because the inner product between the two vectors is invariant. That's what is expressed by saying that the covariant derivative of the metric is vanishing. And the covariant derivative of the metric is always vanishing, right? Even if the space-time has arbitrary wrinkles and hills and valleys and all of that, the covariant derivative of the metric is always vanishing. That's simply saying that the affine connection is compatible with the metric, that lengths and angles are being preserved under parallel transport. That the Lie derivative is vanishing, the Lie derivative of the metric is vanishing, that's highly non-trivial. For that to be true, the metric needs to have some symmetry. The space-time needs to have some symmetry. Okay, so the first term is vanishing, that's cool. And we only have that because we are expressing everything in terms of semicolons here. That's why we can conclude that. Okay, so that means that the condition for Killing vector field can also be written in this way. So to search for Killing vector fields is to search for solutions to this differential equation. And these metrics here can be used to just pull down the index of the contravariant index of the xi. And so we have this equation here. We have xi mu covariant differentiated in the new direction is equal to the negative of doing these things in the other order. In other words, the matrix xi mu semicolon u is supposed to be anti-symmetric. So now let's assume that we actually find Killing vector fields. If we have a Killing vector field, I mean, for example, in Minkowski space, do we find Killing vector fields? Very easy, right? Because this is ordinary derivatives, and then it will be easy, you know, to just take the x direction, y direction, t direction vectors, and they will obey this. But in general, this is highly non-trivial to solve that equation. But let's assume we found a Killing vector field. Then can we identify something that's being conserved? What is the Noether theorem? What is the Noether theorem consequence? If we have a symmetry, so the metric doesn't change under a diffeomorphism, under infinitesimal diffeomorphism, so we have this symmetry, what conservation law follows? And here's the proposition, which is the general relativistic version of Noether's theorem. It says that for every symmetry, that is to say that for every Killing vector field xi of a space-time given by some metric, its matter fields possess a conserved quantity. And that conserved quantity has a flow described by a vector field P superscript mu. And that flow of a conserved quantity, is given by the contraction of the energy momentum tensor with the vector field of the symmetry. So the energy momentum tensor can be used to define a flow of a quantity, P mu. And for that, we use the vector field xi of the symmetry. In principle, we can always define this, right? We can pick any vector field xi we want. And then we contract that with the energy momentum tensor to obtain this vector field P mu. And that can be viewed as describing a flow. However, it's not always a conserved flow. But if Xi is a Killing vector field, then that quantity is a conserved quantity. It describes the flow of a conserved quantity. Why is that? Let's see. So let's calculate the divergence of this. So we calculate p mu and then semicolon mu. Now this is the p mu, so it's this, and then semicolon mu, covariant derivative with respect to mu, and summed over. So by definition, plugging this into here, we obtain that this is t mu nu, xi nu, and then semicolon mu. Remember that the covariant derivative obeys the Leibniz rule. It's a derivation. So this means that since we have two objects in here, we get two terms by the Leibniz rule. We get the covariant derivative of the t mu nu, and we get the covariant derivative of the xi. So we get one term where the t mu nu is covariantly being differentiated. That's here. And we can just carry forward the xi nu. That's this term. And this term is actually vanishing because the t mu nu semicolon mu is always vanishing on every spacetime, right? Symmetry or not, it's always vanishing. Remember, that was this quantity. That was that equation here, this one, that I said is not a conservation law. This comes purely from diffeomorphism invariance, purely from reparametrization invariance. It's essentially a Bianchi identity. Right, so what we have is that we can, if xi is the Killing vector field, we define the p mu, and then we calculate the divergence of it. We get two terms from this function, from this covariant differentiation. The first term vanishes because t mu nu semicolon mu is vanishing. In the equation when I wrote it above, I was contracting the nu with down here, but that doesn't matter because the t mu nu is symmetric. It's a symmetric tensor. And maybe I should, yes, I should have said this earlier. It's symmetric because it arises from functionally differentiating the action with respect to g mu nu. But g mu nu is symmetric, so the t mu nu is symmetric as well. So the first term is vanishing. And then we get another term where we carry forward the t mu nu, and we have to covariantly differentiate the xi. And so we have xi nu semicolon mu. This is also vanishing. And the reason is that t mu nu is symmetric, but xi nu mu is anti-symmetric. Remember, that's that equation here. So because xi, exactly because xi, is a Killing vector field, this is vanishing. So if and only if xi is a Killing vector field, so in other words, if and only if the lead derivative of g in the direction of xi vanishes, then that is vanishing. But remember that this is a divergence. So what we have is, if we now integrate this statement that p mu semicolon mu is equal to 0, if we integrate that statement, so if we take p mu semicolon mu, multiply with the volume form, and integrate it over the region B, then that's the integral over the divergence of p. And then remember from many lectures back, Gauss's theorem, which says that if you integrate the divergence of a vector field, p, then over a bulk of the spacetime, like a bubble B of the spacetime, then by Gauss's theorem, this is the same as plugging that vector field into the volume form, omega, so that you get a new volume form, or a new form, which is an n minus 1 form. Omega, the volume form is a top form, is an n form. But if you plug the vector field via the inner derivation as the first argument into the volume form, you get an n minus 1 form, which can then be integrated over an n minus 1 dimensional manifold, in this case, the boundary of this chunk of spacetime B. So what we obtain is that 0 is equal to the integral over that quantity, over the boundary of that spacetime region. And what that means is, since this is an integral over the boundary, what that means is that as much of p mu as flows into the region B, that much also has to flow out of it. We will later study that in more graphic detail. Yeah, we will use for B, you know, a box in space and in time, and then we can write down exactly those flows. But you can see already from this that the integral over the surface of the region B of that quantity is equal to zero. So as much as flows in, this much also has to flow out. Now, what is that quantity that was being conserved? Was it energy? Was it momentum? Was it potatoes? What was conserved here? And the definition is this. And this is really the definition of energy, the definition of momentum, when revisiting the question from scratch using general relativity. The new definition is that if the Killing vector field psi that we used was a time-like vector, was a time-like vector field, then we call that quantity that is flowing, whose flow is described by the vector p mu, we call that quantity an energy. If, on the other hand, that vector was space-like, then we call that quantity a momentum. And the reason is that if psi is time-like, well, then the symmetry of the space-time is in a time direction. You can choose a coordinate system in which psi is 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. Right? So that means that the space-time doesn't change over time. So you have a translation invariance in time. And from the old-fashioned interstellar flat space, translation invariance in time means energy conservation. So here, more generally, if the vector field is time-like, then we say, if the Killing vector field is time-like, then we say the quantity that it conserves is the energy. And otherwise, it would be the momentum. We will later get also to angular momentum and so on. So since in this way, we can extract from T mu nu energy and momentum energy and momentum flows, P mu. The T mu nu is also called the energy momentum tensor or the stress energy tensor. I prefer to call it the energy momentum tensor. Now this was about fields. What about particles? What if we have point particles that that live on a geodesic? You see here, all of this was with fields. Fields psi, fields p mu. You know, this flow here, p mu, is the flow of energy or of momentum for matter fields and for radiation fields. Because this is defined at every point of the manifold, right? This is a tensor on every point of the manifold. That's a vector field on every point of the manifold. The p mu is a vector field defined on every point of the manifold. What we're dealing with is fields. We're dealing with here the flow of energy, the flow of momentum in a field. But what if we consider old-fashioned point particles? So we throw a billiard ball through space. Then what about its momentum and energy conservation? So again, let's assume that our space-time has a Killing vector field psi. And now, let's assume that we throw a billiard ball through that space-time, which has a Killing vector field psi. So we throw this billiard ball, so we throw a point-like particle on a geodesic gamma. Then the claim is that the quantity q, which is defined by the inner product of the tangent vector, the contraction of the tangent vector to the geodesic, and the Killing vector field, is a conserved quantity along the geodesic. And again, depending on whether psi is time-like or space-like, this quantity is a conserved energy or a conserved momentum. It's called a conserved energy. It's called a conserved momentum. Depending on whether psi is time-like or psi is space-like. And again, you see how in Minkowski space this makes sense. In Minkowski space, the geodesic is just a straight line, right? And then you have that the quantity could be either the the if for example psi is 1 0 0 0, it picks out the first component of the tangent vector, which is the energy component. And then if the psi Killing vector field in Minkowski space is chosen to be, for example, the 0, 1, 0, 0 vector, then it picks out the momentum in the x direction. So let's prove that this quantity is really conserved then. So let's say we denote the tangent vector to the geodesic u. Here I called it gamma dot, but let's just write it more easily as u. So u is the geodesic's tangent vector. Then let us calculate what the covariant derivative is of that quantity q here. Now remember, q is actually a scalar, so therefore the covariant derivative is just the ordinary derivative. So we calculate the covariant derivative of that scalar in the direction of where we travel, the direction of the vector field u, u being the tangent vector to the geodesic. So let's spell this out, what this actually is. It's a covariant derivative in the direction of u. So that is covariant derivative, semicolon k, and then contracted with the direction vector uk. So I'm just spelling out what the nabla u is, right? So it's a derivative in the direction of all the basis vectors and then the coefficient function uk. Okay, now product rule, Leibniz rule. So we have the covariant derivative acting on the xi, the covariant derivative acting on the u. We get therefore two terms here. Here's the term where the covariant derivative acts on the xi. So we carry forward the uk. We covariantly differentiate the xi mu in the direction of k, as we should, and then we carry forward the u mu here. And then we see that the uk u mu, that's symmetric, right? It's a matrix that's symmetric, but this one is anti-symmetric. I mean, we can move those indices down to see the symmetry and also to move that index down so that we get the anti-symmetry of the Killing vector field. So overall, what we have here is a symmetric tensor contracted with an anti-symmetric one, and therefore this is vanishing. And then we have, by the Leibniz rule, a second term where the covariant derivative acts on the u. And everything else gets carried forward. So the u and the xi get carried forward. This u gets covariantly differentiated. And now the uk contracted with the u mu semicolon k is the covariant derivative of the tangent vector in the direction of the tangent vector. This is vanishing because it's a geodesic, right? Because a geodesic is defined by the tangent vector being parallel transported. So that means that that covariant derivative is vanishing. The covariant derivative of the tangent vector in the direction of the tangent vector is equal to 0. So that expression is also vanishing. So therefore, we showed that this quantity, that scalar, is conserved along the geodesic. Okay, so what we saw is that we have, for every Killing vector field, we can derive that the matter fields in total will have, and that's the fields, not particles, but the fields, will have a flow of either energy or momentum described by this vector field p mu. And that flow is conserved because its divergence is 0, and therefore by Gauss's theorem, we have that as much of this flows into a region, that much also flows out of the region. If, on the other hand, we have a Killing vector field and we are interested not in fields, but we're interested in individual test particles that travel on a geodesic, we saw that if we take the Killing vector field and contract it with the tangent vector of a geodesic, then we get a quantity that is either energy or momentum, and it is going to be conserved along the geodesic. So now let's come back to the question of why is this vanishing? How can we see that this covariant derivative of the energy momentum tensor contracted with that index is 0? Remember, it's not a conservation law, because we know conservation law requires more. Conservation law requires that there's a killing vector field. But this is always true, no matter how wild the space-time looks. And here's the intuition. Many variations of the metric, that is to say, the metric goes into a new metric, g tilde, which is the old metric plus some variation. Many of these changes of many of these variations of the metric may not change the manifold at all, because they describe the same Riemannian structure. We may be just changing coordinates. And therefore, we are describing the same thing with new coordinates. The Riemannian structure has not changed. Which means that there is an isometric diffeomorphism, in other words, a charge change, that relates the old metric and to the new metric. See, even in just a region B, we can just change coordinates in there. We can leave the coordinates the same outside that region B, but in that region, we can just twist and move and expand and deform the coordinate system. It still describes the same manifold, but the metric tensor will look different. It's just it only looks different, though, because of a change of coordinates.
Mm-hmm. That was the whole argument of HOLD, Einstein's whole argument?
Oh, no, that's a more complicated story.
So you're changing only in a small region, but the metric remains the same.
Yes, yes. No, let's talk about that later, because it's a whole different story, the whole argument. Okay. So, okay. So what we said is that there are lots of diffeomorphisms that leave the metric invariant, but that are trivial because they're just that just changes of coordinates. Now the metric tensor, however, the energy momentum tensor, however, doesn't distinguish changes of metric that really describe a change of the shape of the manifold from changes of the metric that come about just because we change coordinate system. Instead, the definition of the energy momentum tensor is agnostic about the origin. It's agnostic about what the delta g mu nu does. It just differentiates the action with respect to all of this, right? And so therefore, it depends also on those trivial ones. I mean, trivial in the sense that it's just a reparametrization of the space-time. And for that reason, we should expect that the t mu nu of x contains redundant information. And that's what it does. Let's work that out. First of all, how much is there? How much redundant information is there in the energy momentum tensor? Well, diffeomorphism invariants, that is to relabel points, that is to say I choose the different coordinate system, has 4 degrees of freedom. Namely, the new coordinates are functions of the old coordinates. So each new coordinate is a function of all of the old coordinates. And since there are in space-time 4 coordinates, we have 4 functions that describe that. 4 quite freely choosable functions, the new variables in terms of the old variables. So therefore, we expect that there are 4 equations that express the redundancy that is contained in t mu nu of x. And those 4 equations turn out to be these 4 equations. The t mu nu semicolon nu equal to 0. You see, we are contracting over the nu, so this is 4 equations. One equation for mu equals 0, one equation for mu equals 1, all the way up to mu equal to 3. So finally, let's prove this. And let's see how this comes about exactly. Okay, so for that purpose, let's assume that phi index t is a parameter. It's not time. It's just some parameter. So assume that phi parameterized by t is a diffeomorphism from the manifold into itself that is generated by some vector field xi. So just like above, some vector field xi generates that diffeomorphism. And we assume that the vector field, we choose vector fields that vanish outside the region under consideration, the region B. It vanishes on the boundary of and outside the region B. So the diffeomorphisms map P into P, point into point, into the same point, if the point is outside the region B. So the coordinate system change, or the diffeomorphism, I should say, only acts non-trivially inside that region B. Now, under a change of coordinates, under a change of variables, every integral, no matter what integral, stays the same. It gives us the same output number. Right? And that means, in particular, that when we write down the action, so we write down the Lagrangian density. Remember, the Lagrangian density is the Lagrangian times the square root of g. I just put the square root of g into the L, the Lagrangian, and that made the L a curly L. Okay? Remember that this is a scalar density here. So we can write down the action as the integral over the scalar density of the Lagrangian in the original coordinates x, or we can just change variables in this integral. And as always, when we change variables in the integral, if we do it correctly, if we don't forget chain rule factors and so on, then we obtain the same number. So this action is the same as that action, no matter how I change variables. This is the starting point, and it's a trivial one. We're simply saying that an integral evaluates to the same number, no matter whether we chose to change variables, integration variable or not. So that doesn't require a symmetry, right? It's just a fact of integrals that I can calculate them in whatever coordinate system, with whatever variables I want. Okay, so that means that since this is equal to that, it means that this minus that is equal to 0, which means that 0 is equal to, and then I put here 1 over t because anticipating what we will do next, it would still be true if there wasn't a 1 over t. And here we have the Lagrangian density, and here we have the Lagrangian density just evaluated with a little bit of a change of coordinates, where we do the infinitesimal change of coordinates. So this is the pullback under the infinitesimal change of coordinates generated by the flow psi. So that is a derivative now. So now let's expand this. So we expand the Lagrangian density with respect to what it depends on. Well, it depends on the matter fields psi. Remember from the previous lecture, the matter fields have a lower index I that labels the species. And then it has also contravariant and covariant indices. So we get these two contributions. But in principle, we should also, and this is now important, functionally differentiate the Lagrangian density also with respect to the metric, and then have the change of the metric here. And this part becomes the Lie derivative of the metric, right? Because this is the metric here, this is the metric pulled back, and then with the 1 over t and the limit for t going to 0, this becomes the Lie derivative of the metric. Now, that term here is dl by d psi, and then these chain rule terms. But dl by d psi, under the assumption that the equations of motion hold, the classical equations of motion hold, vanishes, because that's the Euler-Lagrange equations. So that term vanishes. And then we are left with the statement that as we take the limit t going to 0, and this becomes the Lie derivative of the metric, we obtain that 0 equal to, and then here we have the energy momentum tensor, dl by dg mu nu, right? That was the energy momentum tensor. Times square root of g, because actually what we get is the energy momentum tensor density. And then the Lie derivative of the metric here. Now, the Lie derivative of the metric we evaluated before, and we found that the Lie derivative of the metric is given by this formula here, where the first term involves a covariant derivative of the metric itself. It vanishes because of the consistency condition between the affine connection and the metric. Remember, this was this argument that the affine connection is such that the metric is conserved along parallel transport. And then we had these two other terms. If the lead derivative is vanishing, then the sum of these two terms is vanishing, and we say that we have a killing vector field. But we're not assuming here that we have a killing vector field. We're just saying that the lead derivative of the metric comes up here. So what we have is that this equation then becomes that equation, because the lead derivative of the metric becomes these two terms. It's these two terms. Now, the energy momentum tensor is a symmetric tensor. And what we have is that this could be 0 if xi is a killing vector field. But in general, we are not assuming this. In general, it's not that. But what we can write it as, xi b semicolon a as twice that plus this minus that. I'm just adding and subtracting the same thing. Right? We have here this. Here we have it twice, and then I subtract it once. So I'm left with one of those and one of those. So that's just these two. And then this anti-symmetric part cancels away with the because of the symmetry of TAB. So therefore, we obtain that 0 is equal to this. And here, we write this as this 2 TAB xi b semicolon a. We just carry that forward. But then we add and subtract that. So we just add a term and we subtract the same term. So we haven't really done anything here. The point of adding and subtracting that is that these two terms together are the covariant derivative of that. So I take the TAB and then xi b, and the covariant derivative of that gives us two terms, one where the TAB gets covariantly differentiated, that's this term, and another one where this gets carried forward and the xi gets covariantly differentiated, that's that term. So these two become that, and that's cool because that's going to be divergence, and that term is left over here. So now this is the divergence. Why? Because TAB contracted with xi b is a vector with one contravariant index. That's the index A here. Let's call that vector R superscript A. It's this one. And the covariant derivative of it contracted gives us, together with the square root of G, a divergence. But a divergence by Gauss's theorem integrated over the bulk of the region B gives us an integral over the boundary of that region. But the xi is supposed to vanish on the boundary. Remember that we have coordinate changes, or just in general, we have a flow defined by xi, which may or may not be a killing vector, it's just arbitrary. But the xi, which defines that flow, which defines that diffeomorphism, should vanish outside and on the boundary. So outside the region B and on the boundary as well. So that we are not having any changes of coordinates outside, it's just everything confined to that region. And since this expression here, this R, has the xi in it, and since the xi vanishes by definition on the boundary of the region B, the R vanishes on the boundary of the region B, and therefore that integral vanishes because the integrand vanishes on the boundary of the region B. So that term goes away, and we're just left with this. So therefore, what we have is that this expression is equal to 0. We just carry that forward here. The 2 we can forget now, because the whole thing is 0, right? We started with 0 equal 2. So we have that. This integral here, so that's the energy momentum tensor, covariantly differentiated and then contracted and then multiplied with contracted with this this vector field psi, and then multiplied with the volume form and integrated up over B, is vanishing for all psi. And since this is true for all psi, and I can choose the psi to be, you know, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, or 0, 1, 0, 0, and so on, I can choose all psi, therefore, that thing itself has to vanish, right? So therefore, from that, we can conclude that this expression is vanishing. And what we see here is that the reason is not, this is true not because of any symmetries. We did not use the psi as a Killing vector field. If psi had been a Killing vector field, we could have, you know, used that here, and we would have very easily found 0 equal to 0, right? But we are not assuming that psi is a Killing vector field. This is always true just because of the reparametrization invariance. There is some redundancy, redundant information in the energy momentum tensor. So then how do we calculate an energy momentum tensor? Remember that the energy momentum tensor is defined as 2 divided by the square root of g, and then the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric. And remember that the action is defined by the Lagrangian scalar times the volume form. And if we bracket differently, if we put these two things together, then we would write a curly L and call it the Lagrangian density. It's a scalar density then. Okay, so now we need to calculate this functional derivative here. And remember that the delta G mu nu can always be written by definition as an actual variation of the metric that is parameterized by some parameter lambda. And so what we need to do is do this differentiation explicitly now. So we differentiate S with respect to lambda at lambda equal to 0. That gives us the functional derivative at g, at the g mu nu that has not been changed. So we obtain multiple terms. One term is obtained by taking this expression and differentiating it with respect to the metric. And then, of course, we differentiate the metric with respect to lambda. But dg mu nu by d lambda is by definition what we write as the variation of gab. Right? So this is equal to dgab by d lambda. It's just another way of writing it. Okay, so there is a metric dependence in here, and that's captured by this derivative. But then, in principle, we can also say, well, let's see, we also have that L depends on psi, so we can differentiate with respect to the psi, and then the variation times the variation of psi. But the variation of psi is 0. We are not varying with respect to the matter fields. We are only varying with respect to the metric. So this is not there. We don't have to differentiate with respect to the matter fields. But there is another dependence in here on the metric. Namely, there is that this. It depends on the metric, of course. So we also have to, when we differentiate, functionally differentiate the action with respect to the metric, then we have to differentiate with respect to explicit occurrences of the metric in here. That's this derivative. And also with respect to that. And then there's yet another very hidden dependence on the metric in here. I'll show you in a moment. But for now, we have to also differentiate the action with respect to the occurrence here. So we have to differentiate. We carry forward the L, and then we have the functional derivative of the square root of g with respect to the metric. And I'll leave it to you as an exercise that the outcome of that is 1 half the metric times the square root of g. And then there is yet another quite hidden dependence of the metric in here. And that's in the covariant derivatives of the matter fields. Because the covariant derivatives of the matter fields include not just ordinary derivatives, but also the affine connection. But the affine connection depends on the metric, right? So the fields themselves don't have that metric dependence, but the covariant derivatives of the field, they have a metric dependence through the dependence on the affine connection that comes up in the covariant derivatives, which means we have to also consider dL by d psi, the meta fields, covariantly differentiated, and then the variation of the covariantly differentiated fields, which is not vanishing, even though we are not varying with respect to the fields, we are varying with respect to the metric, but these variations depend on the metric. So what is this variation then? Well, that variation here, this one, this variation is what we get when we differentiate the psi with respect to the gamma, and then we have the variation of the gammas. And remember that the variation of the gamma is tensorial, and here it is. We have that the Christoffel symbol is a known expression in terms of the metric. If you drop the deltas, if you drop the deltas, this is just expressing the Christoffel symbol in terms of the metric, and now we are looking at the variation of it. So therefore, this variation of the covariant derivatives of the matter fields can be expressed in this way. So we have this contribution, that contribution, and this one. Now here, we have not the variations of the metric itself. What we have is variations of, it's the covariant derivatives of the variation of the metric. It's not the variation of the covariant derivative of the metric that would vanish. The covariant derivative of the metric always vanishes. No, what it is we have the variation of the metric covariantly differentiated. And here too, and here that too. But what we want is that this term takes the same form as this one and as that one, so that we can draw a nice conclusion later. And what I mean by the same form is that there's something times variation of g. And here too, something times variation of g. Here we haven't achieved that yet, because here we have something times variation of g covariantly differentiated. Variation of g covariantly differentiated, and so on. That's a mess, right? So we cannot factor that out. It would be nice to have simply this plus that plus something here times variation of g, right? So what we can do is we can do an integration by parts now, so that this covariant differentiation is not acting on the variation of g, but is acting on the rest of the expression in here. I leave that business to you. It's a little tedious, and we have only a limited amount of time for this. So we can do that, and then the variation of this can actually be expressed in terms of a variation of g mu nu, and then the terms can be collected. We have this times the variation of g, this times the variation of g, whatever comes out of here times the variation of g, and then everything that we collect to the left of that, so this part plus that part plus here whatever is to the left after the integration by parts of this thing, all of that times variation of g mu nu. That's then the functional derivative of s with respect to lambda. So all of that stuff to the left, all of that that we collected is the t mu nu, is the energy momentum tensor. The energy momentum tensor has three contributions, this one, that one, and this hidden one. So now all that remains is to actually do this for a concrete matter field, for a concrete action, like the Klein-Gordon action or the electromagnetic action and so on. You can go through this, go through that, and collect the terms from here, from there, and from here. Let's do that in an example. Okay, so here we have the Klein-Gordon action. with the potential just to make it a little more interesting. So then the Klein-Gordon action, it's of course now with covariant derivatives, where it used to be in Minkowski space with ordinary derivatives. And here we have a potential function psi of V of psi. We have to functionally differentiate that with respect to the metric. And we have the metric occurring here in the affine connection. We have the metric occurring here. And we have the metric occurring there. And so we write it all out here. And the variation of the square root of g with respect to the metric is this expression here. That was an exercise of two or three slides ago. And we can use that GAB, GBC is just the Kronecker delta. Its variation is vanishing because it's always the Kronecker delta, because the metric with the lower and the metric with the upper indices are always just inverse to each other. And if we plug all that in here, we can read off the energy momentum tensor density to be this expression here. The energy momentum tensor is obtained by just dropping the square root of g. So overall, the energy momentum tensor takes this form. It has this kinetic term here. It has a kinetic term there. And then it has also a potential contribution. And notice that the energy momentum tensor comes out to be symmetric, as it always does. The energy moment, by the way, the energy momentum tensor existed even before general relativity was invented or was discovered. But the energy momentum tensor then, of course, was always calculated for flat space. And I just want to know, you know, how does a fluid, for example, carry energy? How does it carry momentum? And then the energy momentum tensor was calculated, but there was some ambiguity in the definition. And it was not necessarily symmetric. You could also define an anti-symmetric one. But general relativity calculates the energy momentum tensor in a fresh way. This calculation would not have been possible before general relativity, because we are obtaining the energy momentum tensor by calculating a derivative with respect to the metric. Whereas in Minkowski space, there is no change in the metric considered, right? And so it's a completely different way of arriving at the energy momentum tensor. Now, for the electromagnetic field, you can go through the same procedure, and you find that the energy momentum tensor takes this form here, where F mu nu is the field strength tensor. I'm rushing a little bit through those two examples because, in any case, it's good if you go through them carefully yourself and try to reproduce them. I want to cover an important set of definitions at the end. And the first definition is that of a so-called perfect fluid. And these definitions are preparation for cosmology later on. So, I mean, next in our program is, of course, general relativity, the Einstein equation, and then properties and solutions and so on. But eventually, we get to cosmology, and inflationary cosmology. And there, these definitions that relate to the energy momentum tensor will come up again and be important. So let's first start with something that appears relatively unrelated. It's fluids. Now, you can imagine your space-time being filled with a fluid. That fluid could be for example, hydrogen gas. But that fluid could also be galaxies, where every galaxy counts as a grain of dust. Right? So, what is a perfect classical fluid? A perfect classical fluid is a fluid which at every point has a unique time-like flux direction, vector field v mu. That's not trivial. For example, you could have that a fluid that consists of air and of snowflakes. And the snowflakes don't always go the same way that the air does, right? Because they have their own inertia. The air might go mostly this way, horizontal, but the snowflakes will still insist to go also downwards, right? So you can have different components in the fluid that actually don't go the same way. And so a perfect fluid is one where there is a well-defined, unique time-like flux direction, vector field v mu, and the flux is conserved, and the fluid is completely characterized by only two parameters, namely the local energy density, that may be called mu, and the local pressure, P. So there is no viscosity, there is no shear in that fluid. So it's not supposed to be like honey or something like that. So like, you know, a hydrogen gas, for example. Okay, so a gas that has a well-defined flux direction vector V, and all its properties are defined by the energy momentum, by the energy density, and by the pressure. Then the energy momentum tensor, this comes from fluid mechanics, is the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid is can be written in the following form. Here is the velocity field, V mu. I mean, this is all dependent on x and t, right? So here we have the velocity field, V mu, V nu. And here we have the energy density plus the pressure. And here we have the pressure times the energy momentum tensor. This is just from fluid mechanics. I'm not trying to motivate that here. A perfect fluid is called a perfect dust if it's pressureless. For example, galaxies don't exert pressure on each other. So the galaxies form like dust particles in the universe if you want to view it as a gas. And for example, if you consider the equation of motion of such a perfect fluid, it's actually this equation. And if it was the case of dust, then that equation means it translates into the fact, for p equal to 0, that these dust particles travel on geodesics. But that's not important. I'm just saying that as an aside. And now a big step. Along come Hawking and Ellis. And they say, this is all good and fine, but it's fluid mechanics. We are interested mostly, in the early universe especially, we are mostly interested in fields. And they now take this terminology from fluid mechanics and apply it to cosmology. And they say that whenever you calculate an energy momentum tensor, and it may come from spinner fields or from electromagnetism or from whatever, whenever you calculate an energy momentum tensor, for example, like this one or like that one, whenever you have one that happens to be of a form that resembles this, vector times vector, something scalar in front, I mean some number valued in front, and then here number times g mu nu. If the energy momentum tensor takes this form, and that's by no means given, this doesn't take that form. So, well, it can, but it depends. Whenever the energy momentum tensor does take this form, then we use the terminology of fluid mechanics, and we call this energy density plus pressure, and we call this pressure, and we call the whole thing a perfect fluid. And that's motivated by the fact that the energy momentum tensor of a Klein-Gordon field often actually takes that form. And then we speak of the energy momentum, then we speak of the energy density and the pressure of a Klein-Gordon field as if it was a fluid. So it's just a terminology here. And by the way, another terminology or notation, the ratio of pressure to energy density is called W. And that W parameter is, for example, zero if there is no pressure, right? So for galaxies, for example, it would be zero, the W parameter. W parameter is super important. In cosmology, they talk about it all the time. And the message here is the W parameter comes from Hawking and Ellis's decision. I think they were the first, but maybe there were others who did it earlier. Of their goes back to their decision to say that whatever energy momentum tensor you have coming up from fundamental principles, if it takes that form, we identify here energy and momentum and flow vectors and so on as if it was that. So in particular, and this is going to be crucial for cosmology later on, what we have is this. Let's consider the Klein-Gordon energy momentum tensor that we had in the slide just up here. Right? It's this one. We just calculated it here. by first principles, right? We functionally differentiated the action with respect to the metric. And then we got the energy momentum tensor of the Klein-Gordon field. And that's what we got. Now let's see, can we massage that into the form of the perfect fluid energy momentum tensor? And we can under certain conditions. Namely, let's assume that psi is almost homogeneous, which is a really good approximation in the early universe where the Klein-Gordon field is almost constant in space. Not in time, but in space, it's almost constant. Which means that the spatial derivatives, so the derivatives in the I directions, where I equal 1, 2, 3, is approximately 0. Which means that in here, we essentially only have the time derivatives. They dominate over the space derivatives. And here too. Then we can write the Klein-Gordon energy momentum tensor in this form. We can write it in this form where we have this prefactor and then VV vectors, where the VV vectors, the V mu, V nu vectors are defined in this way. Right? So we define a V vector in this way, and then the first term here, this term, becomes that term, and we have that the G mu nu times that becomes is this expression here. And that simplifies under the assumption that the space derivatives are unimportant, are almost zero. We obtain that this reduces just to psi dot squared, so the time derivatives, and here as well. And now we can compare. And we can say, aha, we have here the VV, and then we have a prefactor. So the mu plus p is psi dot squared, and here the p is all of that. And if you put that together, you find that the mu plus p over p is, I mean, that's just trivial, that this is 1 over w plus 1 by definition, that this is that ratio here. And from that, we can then calculate what the w parameter is for a Klein-Gordon field. Super important. I don't think you will find a cosmology talk that doesn't talk about the W parameter, especially for a Klein-Gordon field. Because in cosmology, as far as we know, the very early universe was dominated by the Klein-Gordon field of the inflaton Klein-Gordon field. And the W parameter is going to be super important, as we will see later in the course. For now, let's take away that the ratio of pressure over energy, that's what W is, right? It's the ratio of pressure divided by energy, energy density, in the analogy with the perfect fluid. That ratio is given by that. Now, what values can this take? Well, you see, either the psi dot squared dominates or the V dominates. If the psi dot squared dominates, well, then we can drop these two and we just get 1. W is 1. On the other hand, if the V is dominant, so if the potential is dominant, it's very important. If the potential in the Klein-Gordon equation is dominant, then the W parameter can be as small as minus 1. So the W parameter ranges between plus 1 and minus 1. And all of the interesting physics of the very early universe plays out as W ranges between minus 1 and plus 1. As we will later see, the W parameter is so important because in the equations of motion, in the Einstein equation later on, the W parameter determines how fast the universe will expand. And in particular, if W is minus 1, then it expands exponentially fast. Then we have inflation. And what is confusing the hell out of a lot of people is that the experimental evidence indicates that W might be smaller than minus 1. A little bit smaller. It doesn't have to be, but it's kind of favored a little bit that W is smaller than minus 1. And then something breaks because we don't know how that would happen, that W is smaller than minus 1. Which would be super dramatic. For W smaller than minus 1, the universe would not only, it would super exponentially expand and have a big rip. where in a finite amount in the future, a finite amount of time in the future, it would be, have an infinite rip. But of course, there's no way we can predict the future so far ahead, while we still don't know what is dark energy, what is dark matter. There's no way we can actually reliably predict the future. But what the experimental evidence says is that the W parameter is super important. It describes a lot, but for some reason, it might be smaller than minus one, and Klein-Gordon fields cannot account for that.
So two questions. So the Klein-Gordon team in the distress energy tensor due to the Klein-Gordon field, you assume that, and you assume the perfect fluid, and then you get that the W is a function.
Yes, you take the Klein-Gordon field energy momentum tensor, you make the assumption that the space derivatives are small, then you can identify these terms. You can put this into that form, where the V is defined like that.
Okay, so
and then you can read off what the mu and the P are, and you get the W.
We technically have only one form of the stress energy tensor, but then let's just say they correspond to each other, for example, the V so in terms of the psi.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a unique way that this takes that form.
Okay. Yeah. And also, so you don't have to choose a cosmological model to do that. There is no solution chosen here. It's just that.
Because we assume that these space derivatives are almost zero, which basically gives us FRW, where we have spatial flatness.
Yeah, spatial homogeneity as well as isotropy for the.
Yeah.
Right, okay. You basically assume a certain number of Killing vector fields in a sense.
So yes. Well, not exactly, right? Because we just want this approximately to be zero. I mean, something has to give. You're asking the right question, right? Something has to give.
Right.
It could also be that there's some other species of particle out there which has some funny kind of potentials. Who knows? Something that makes this go perhaps to smaller than minus one. I mean, it's not a given. The error bars are such that W might be exactly one, minus one, or very close to it. But the error bars go clearly also towards lower than minus one. For example, for the electromagnetic field, the energy momentum tensor, also in certain circumstances, like these circumstances, also takes roughly the perfect fluid scenario here, and if electromagnetic radiation was dominant, then the W would come out to be a third, as we will later see. So that doesn't help.
Also, I guess people sort of tweaked the size and with the stress energy tensor so that this pops up in a sense, so that that works in a sense that corresponds to a perfect fluid with a W being.
No. I mean, there's nothing forced here. That comes out. But yes, you have to assume this. But remember that if that was not zero, it would contribute on the side of the V here, not on the side of that. It just has the opposite sign there. I don't think that would help. Also, well, maybe it's worth looking into. Okay, I'm out of time. I have to rush to the university now. Okay.
See you next week.